Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd legislative session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier. Vice Chair Frazier. Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins. Representative Hewitt.
Hewitt present.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller present.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston. Representative Poston. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Chung.
Present.
Collins present.
But Frazier's present as well.
And that concludes roll call.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Abdullahi. We do have a quorum. And I want to remind the members of the public that this hearing is being held, is being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing members to debate and vote by means of distant voting, remote electronic voting, or other means to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing can be viewed via the House website. A link for that is present on our committee website page. Those interested in testifying can email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamel Lundy, 24 hours before a hearing. And that email is also found on the committee website page. Representative Vang, I think you have a motion before us for adoption of the February 4th committee hearing.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Vang moves adoption of the February 4th committee hearing. Let me make sure I've got the right date. Yes. And discussion.
Chair Mariani.
Yes, please, Representative Poston.
I am very sorry to interrupt you, but I am here. I was having a problem with my computer when they did roll call.
Very well.
So I am present.
Very well. It's an appropriate interruption, Representative Poston. Representative Poston, I was actually looking for your cell phone because I wanted to circle back and have a conversation with you about those school safety ideas. So let's maybe after the committee, let's make sure we connect, arrange for that.
Sounds good.
Okay, very well. Representative, any other discussion? Representative Johnson, voice phone, I take it? Okay.
That would be just fine.
Very well. All in favor of the Vang motion to adopt the February 4th minutes of this committee, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Vang. Members, we have three bills up today. we're not going to move these bills because they involve appropriations. And so they're good candidates for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill later on in this session. Nonetheless, we're going to have them presented, and hopefully we'll have some really good discussion today. I would ask all our testifiers to please be as succinct as possible so that we can have an opportunity for questions and answer and discussion with and among the committee members. With that, Representative Hollins, I believe you have our first bill, House File 861. And Representative Hollins, I think you have a motion before us.
Sorry, can you say that last bit? I didn't catch it.
You have a motion before us?
Yes. We have a author's amendment that I would like to move.
Right. Representative Hollins moves House File 861. And the motion is to for possible inclusion. In our omnibus bill. And so, Representative Hollins, your bill is before us. Representative Hollins, do you want to do your author's amendment now, or do you want to wait till later?
I would prefer to do my author's amendment now.
Very well. Okay. Well, why don't we do this? Why don't you give us a very quick description of 861, and then describe the author's amendment. And actually, boy, you can tell I'm rusty. Representative Hollins, we need to have a motion. So Representative Hollins moves adoption of the A1 amendment. So that motion is before us. And Representative Hollins, tell us quickly about your bill and then tell us about the amendment. And then we'll go into a deeper dive in the bill.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I am also very rusty, so I apologize. House File 861 is a bill appropriating funds for survivor support and prevention grants. And it's being requested by the Victims Coalition in coalitions in Minnesota. What this is a bill that appropriates funds to award grants to victim survivors of crime, and in particular, domestic violence survivors and victims of other crimes. And so during the pandemic, we've seen a dramatic increase in domestic abuse, and this funding really ensures that victim service organizations have the resources they need to provide necessary services to protect victims and to prevent future violence. If you want me to go on, so the funding helps fill the direct needs of programs and survive programs and survivors by providing direct client assistance to survivors, competitive wages for direct staff services, hotel stays, and culturally responsive programming and preventative programming. And I can speak to the amendment if you would like me to.
Representative Hollins, yeah, let's do that. But let me, because the chair is indeed rusty, let me make sure the correct motion is before us. Laying a bill over for possible inclusion is an act that we take. The proper motion would be to refer House File 861 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is that your motion, Representative Hollins?
Yes, that is my motion.
Very well. Representative Hollins moves that House File 861 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and Representative Hollins moves the A1 amendment. To the A1 amendment, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment is very simple. What it does is it just updates the years that we're looking at, the fiscal years, as well as the amount. So we're looking to appropriate $12.5 million in fiscal year 23, and then $8.75 million is added to base funding for fiscal year 24 and beyond.
So Representative Hollins, this amendment will put the bill in the shape you wish to have it.
It would, yes.
Members, discussion? Representative Johnson, are you okay with a voice vote, since it just puts the bill in the shape of the author wishes it to be before us?
That would be fine.
Very well. All in favor of Representative Hollins' A1 amendment motion, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails. And House File 861 is amended before us. Representative Hollins, to your bill.
Thank you. I've really said most of what I need to say about this bill. I would just like to emphasize that this funding is incredibly crucial right now because of the increase we've seen in domestic abuse, as well as other crimes. And providing that direct assistance is so invaluable for individuals who are victims of crimes. And I have two victim coalition stakeholders here to speak on the importance of the bill, Guadalupe Lopez and Artika Roller.
Very well. Director Lopez, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you. I would like to actually pass it over to Artika Roller to start us off today, please.
Very well. Ms. Roller, welcome to you back to our committee. Director Roller, please state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My name is Artika Roller. Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I'm Artika Roller, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And again, I'm here with Director Guadalupe Lopez from Violence Free Minnesota. We are here today to testify in support of House File 861, an increase in base funding to crime victim services so survivors can access the services and the supports they need to take care of themselves and their children. Our request matches what is included in the governor's budget and the governor's recommendations. $12.5 million for fiscal year 2023 and $17.5 million in ongoing funding thereafter. Although that's a substantial amount of funds, this is just the beginning of what we need to close the gap and services that victims and survivors need. House File 861 is supported by each of the five statewide coalitions working to end violence and abuse in our state of Minnesota. That includes, again, Violence Free Minnesota, MnCASA, as well as the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, Mending the Sacred Hoop Coalition, and the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. In order for us to meet the demands of this moment, our elected officials must invest in our community-based advocacy services for victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. As with every helping sector, our sector is facing a dramatic staffing shortfall. So many advocates are victims themselves, yet they struggle to gain the financial stability while using their skills, their expertise, to support people who are in similar situations than they once found themselves in. We are hearing from programs like CADA, located in southern Minnesota, a member program serving victims and survivors of relationship abuse and sexual assault. They are losing their advocates to retail places like Walmart, who offer more competitive wages than we are able to offer our staff. We have heard from programs that they were able to hire additional staff with one-time PPE and COVID funds, but the demand for services has only continued to grow, and programs are struggling to remain adequately staffed to meet the current needs and the complexities of those cases. While one-time funds have been able to provide some programs with temporary relief, we need a robust and a long-term investment in crime victim services in our state. Crime victim services, in fact, have not increased, or their base funding has not increased in over 7 years. A little bit about the data that we've collected from our programs. Crisis calls are up 153% from 2 years ago. In 2018, CADA had over 5,300 phone calls. In 2019, that increased to 6,600 phone calls. In 2020, we had a dramatic jump to 8,194 phone calls for crisis calls with CADA. Their direct service assistant fund, these are funds that go directly to survivors and victims, is up 314%. In 2021. In 2019, they distributed to survivors and victims $30,000. In 2020, they distributed $75,000 and still had additional people waiting for funds. Standpoint, our statewide program providing legal advocacy, says that they have seen a 62% increase in individuals served over the past 2 years. In their first quarter in 2020, they served 700 victims. In 2021, over 800, nearly 900 individuals were served. In 2022, the first quarter of this year, they have already served 1,142 individuals through their services. And then finally, PAVSA, a sexual assault program servicing Southern Minnesota and St. Louis County, Southern St. Louis County, 29% increase in their sexual assault exams performed in the past year. In 2021, they've already have completed 151 sexual assault exams. There has been 14 cases that requested a sexual assault exam, and there was not a sexual assault nurse available to assist those victims. The increased demand for services have put other strains on our member programs serving victims and survivors. Programs across the state tell us that the quality of responses across systems have declined, therefore requiring them to do much more case management than they were doing in the past. And a lack of affordable legal representation available for victims, such as divorce, custody, OFPs, is widespread. There is a need for more sane nurses, especially in rural areas, and many other challenges and gaps in services exist now within our programs. I will now turn it over to Ms. Lopez with Violence Free Minnesota to talk through what an increase of support will look like.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I'm Guadalupe Lopez, Executive Director with Violence Free Minnesota. I'm testifying today in solidarity with Artica and Mikasa in support for our ask for ongoing increased base funding for crime victim services. An increase in funding of victim services will support victim survivors' access to direct client access funds to remove barriers and prevent immediate needs to safety to allow them to meet the basic needs for themselves and their children. We are hearing from programs across the state that requests for direct client assistance have increased significantly. We have heard that programs spent funding originally intended to hire staff to instead be shifted to direct client assistance and to meet the needs of increased demand on our communities. Crimes, and violent crimes in particular, have a significant financial impact on victim survivors. Direct client assistance funding would help crime victims with financial losses and increased costs that are a result of violence. Things like replacing broken doors, assisting relocation costs, paying for uncovered mental health and healthcare costs, assisting with rental deposits, childcare, and more. An increase in funding for victim services will support programs' ability to assist victim survivors with their housing needs. Domestic violence is one of the five key reasons why Minnesotans experience homelessness. Creating a crisis for women, children, and particularly those from Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color. In 2021, 24% of Minnesota victims of intimate partner homicide experienced housing instability. As we increase to access financial stability and affordable housing, we increase safety for victim survivors and relationship abuse, and we work towards preventing domestic violence. An increase in state funding for victim services, we allow for increased work in violence prevention. Prevention includes safe, affordable housing and pathways towards financial stability, alongside community education and healthy relationship trainings to youth in prevention, to prevent this from happening in the first place. Prevention also includes programming to transform abusive behaviors and end the cycle of violence. In order to transform the landscape of violence in Minnesota, we must address repeat violence by providing funding for domestic abuse transformation programming, restorative justice, and other programs to change abusive behavior. Victim survivors continuously request accountability and services for those who use violence in hopes to change the behavior and that the abuse stops, not only for them, but for their children and any future victims. domestic violence programs have a direct and immediate impact on the public safety of Minnesotans. We urge you to support House File 861 for an ongoing increase in base funding. Crime Victim Services will sustain and expand these critical public safety operations. We need your continued commitment to prioritize the safety and survivors of children and their caregivers and the communities across Minnesota. Chief McWitchin, thank you.
Just realized I was muted. Thank you, Director Lopez and Director Roller. We do have some questions, and so Representative Hollins, it'd be appropriate to move to your colleagues for questions, I take it?
Yes, absolutely.
Very well. We'll begin with Representative Rowley, and we'll move to Representative Frazier. Representative Rowley.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure I've got the first part clarified. Ms. Roller stated, I thought, a higher number in the out years. Representative Hollins, A1 amendment said 8.75 million per year, and I thought I heard a number that was something like 12 or 17. I didn't quite get it.
Representative Hollins.
I can tell you what my numbers say and what the amendment says, but I do you want to ask Ms. Roller what she said?
I think I might have heard a different number too, Representative Rowley. Mm-hmm. We're going to go by the number in the motion before us, for sure.
All right, thank you, Chair. So then, to my question, if we've got 12.5 million in fiscal year 23, 8.75 million in 2024 and beyond, that looks like over the next 10 years, $100 million of what we're appropriating for this particular bill. The state already has a crime victims reparation board, and that makes payments to crime victims. So is this $100 million in addition to that program? And I've got a couple other sub-questions to that, please, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rowley. Good question. We did talk about this in the last session and the one prior, but Representative Hollins and perhaps also the directors can comment about the interplay between those and, you know, perhaps some of the issues as well that might exist within the existing funds.
Yeah, absolutely. I am going to ask, I believe Katie Kramer is on to answer some questions. Are you able to speak to this?
Yes, I can speak to this briefly. Representative Raleigh.
Katie Kramer, how are you? Good to see you. Give us your name for reference and who you're with, and then dive into the question there.
Apologies, Chair. Thank you for that. Hello, everyone. My name is Katie Kramer. I'm the Policy Director with Violence Free Minnesota. Chair and Representative Raleigh, thank you for the question. So we did discuss this a little bit last session, so I appreciate you bringing this up again. There is currently an emergency fund that the state runs, and that is run through a program called Cornerstone. But unfortunately, currently, those emergency funds are not accessible to victims of domestic and sexual violence. So they're only accessible to victims of general crimes. And so that was something that was brought up to our attention and that we wanted to bring to your attention last session. And so that's why there was really a big need for that direct client assistance, specifically for survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Certainly there are reparations, and I know that there have been some challenges with getting access to those for survivors, but we're specifically talking about folks who experienced, again, domestic or sexual violence, getting access to those needs to sort of recover and heal from the violence.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So one of the things that we've heard over and over again is, and Ms. Lopez also had mentioned it, and that's the question of accountability. Through the chair to Representative Hollins, I'm not seeing any accountability or reporting requirements for the $100 million over the next 10 years back to the legislature. Can't say the word. Could you address reporting back to us as legislators?
Representative Rowley, you're a man after my heart. I spent my entire
I'm listening, Chair.
Asking that question year after year, committee after committee. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. I don't think I have an answer for that. I know that when this was passed before, it hasn't had a reporting requirement. I could certainly defer to, Katie if she would like to speak to this, or we could talk to the House fiscal team.
Well, let's do this because it is a good inquiry. One, we should probably know whether or not there's anything already baked into this area in terms of reporting, and perhaps Ms. Kramer might be the best that can answer that. But I think also hearing from the directors about, you know, the wisdom and the openness, if you will, about that kind of adding that kind of accountability, if you will, language. To this. So let me start with you, Ms. Kramer.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I will say that there are some reporting requirements through the Office of Justice Programs. So they are the administrator of funds to domestic and sexual violence programs. So they would be a great resource in terms of the information that they already collect. But you're right in that there isn't anything about a direct report to the legislature in this. But certainly programs who receive funds do have to do reporting back to OJP.
And Directors Lopez and or Roller, some quick thoughts on this?
Chair, yes, I would agree with Ms. Kramer that there is extensive reporting that we do, fiscal and reporting around services that are delivered for every grantee of the dollars received through the Office of Justice Programs.
Very well. Representative Raleigh?
Thank you, Chair. Last question that I've got on this particular bill is, we know that the governor's budget also has a request for an additional $10 million for crime victim survivor grants. Is this appropriation of $100 million in addition to that $10 million? So would we stack that on top? How would we view it? Because, Chair, what I'm looking at is, you know, we've got a lot of money that's being requested, and that's why I'm taking the time to, you know, add some of these up and try to figure out where all this money is going. And then after it goes somewhere, can we account for where it went? So that's the basis of my question, Chair.
Excellent inquiries. Let me start with you, Representative Hollins. The interplay with the governor's funds. Are we talking about the same numbers? Are we talking about in addition to those numbers? And perhaps your testifiers might have some insight on this.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. I appreciate the question. I appreciate what you're trying to get at here, like keeping track of the funds. I'm going to defer to my advocates again and just and get their perspective on it, because I'm sure they've been following this a lot more closely.
All right, Director Roller or Lopez or Ms. Kramer.
Hi, Katie Kramer here again with Bond Street, Minnesota. I can jump in, Chair. I'm unfamiliar with the other $10 million in the governor's budget. Perhaps, and I don't, perhaps Ben Johnson could shed some light on that in case he has more information. We know the numbers that we provided match the governor's budget specifically for crime victim services, so I'm not sure about the other $10 million that you're referring to, Representative Raleigh. Hoping we can get some more information, perhaps, from House staff.
And it might be something that, as we hear the governor's budget, we should keep this question top of mind. I don't think we've seen that yet.
I haven't.
And so, you know, I hate for us to be speculative, but I do think, you know, it's important inquiry to make sure, we're properly counting and making sure we're not double counting and, you know, those kind of things.
And Chair, you just brought up the last part, and this is a very short question, and then I'm finished on this bill. You brought up the point that you want to make sure that we're not double accounting. What I'm driving towards with this also is with the Office of Justice Programs, with the Crime Victims Reparation Board, with the crime victim survivor grants. The reason for the reporting is I want to make sure that we are taking care of the vulnerable in our communities and that we have the ability to meet their needs. But I also want to make sure that we've got safeguards in place that they're not going to bounce from one organization to another. And I'm wondering how we account for a victim going to one of these organizations, like let's say the Office of Justice Programs, receiving a grant or receiving money and then applying to the Victims Reparation Board. And how are we making sure that we've got a consistent and centralized way of doing this? Because to me, it feels like we're starting to tendril out and have multiple organizations that may have the same mission. So how do we account for that money? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's a lot there, Representative Rowley. I appreciate that. I think the inquiry maybe could be more broadly, framed. I don't think we want to leave the impression with the public that victims are shopping around for different resources. A victim is a victim, and a hurting human being for sure. But I do think that there's something here about how we can best efficiently, effectively coordinate, state resources to be, of most help for crime victims and survivors. I think this inquiry probably will and should, and I'd be glad to call on you at the time, Representative Rowley, be part of our conversation with the governor when their budget comes forward. I also would encourage you to follow up with Representative Hollins and or the advocates. Maybe there's good language that folks can you all can come up together to make sure there's some good reassurances of maximal impact of state resources in the lives of people. Thank you, Representative Rowley. I appreciate the spirit of your engagement here. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I got a couple of questions, but I just want to say, Representative Rowley, when he talked about the resources and multiple organizations being out here, I just think it speaks to the need for these organizations and the need that we're seeing here in Minnesota and the need that we're seeing across the country. And Ms. Roller and Ms. Lopez, they spoke to this. They spoke to the uptick in terms of these resources being needed in our communities. This question goes to, it's probably not Rep. Hollins, but probably to Ms. Lopez or Ms. Roller. The question is, one of you mentioned that you hired on some new staff with the payroll protection plan money. So my question is, are those staff still on? And if not, when were they let go and how has that impacted your program so far?
Was that to Ms. Roller or Ms.?
I think Ms. Roller may have mentioned that.
Director Roller.
Chair and Representative Frazier, thank you for your question. This was one of our member programs located in, I think, southern Minnesota. Mm. And yes, those staff are still employed at the organization, but this staff is, this program is still really talking about trying to find ways to keep those staff after hiring them with the PPP. One-time funding. I think the other thing that they are extremely concerned about during this time is the competitive wages and being able to support staff and staff's family with the wages that we are currently paying our staff. I think personally at MnCASA, we're also experiencing that and going back and talking about how do we keep staff within our organization that are victims and survivors that have a level of expertise we need to do this work, but we're just not competitive, not only with other nonprofit organizations, but we're also competing with government and for-profit as well.
Very well, thank you, Director Roller. We have four member questions. Let's try to move really quickly. We still have two other bills we wanna make sure we hear. Representative, what do I have here? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this bill.
I listened to the testimony from Katie from Violence Prevention Minnesota, and she said that we were not, the reason why we needed this extra funding is because that victims of domestic violence and sexual assault were not awarded money from the other organization that Representative Brawley was talking about. So my question is, why is this not renamed just for this? If this is meeting a need that isn't being met, then why is it just victims of crimes? And then to follow up is, it says in the language that the coalition is going to be creating the eligibility for these grants. And I just wanted to know if there's more transparency on how that was going to happen, if there was going to be any input from other stakeholders about how the grant eligibility was going to be created. So that goes to whoever can answer that. Hopefully the bill author, but if not, whoever can answer that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mueller. We actually did spend some good time last year talking about, you know, the importance and the distinction of this, but it certainly is worth repeating. And I think, Representative Kramer, you gave us that testimony, or one of the people last year. So maybe you can speak to that, and also to the transparency regarding the eligibility requirements that will be developed.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the question, Representative Mueller. So again, specifically in terms of where domestic and sexual violence victims are excluded, is specifically in the emergency fund. So that is one pot of money. I believe it's about $4 million per year, I believe. And the reason why domestic and sexual violence victim survivors were excluded is because the need specifically for that population was so great that the fund was being used up almost immediately based on the incredible need of victim survivors of domestic and sexual violence. And so because of that, there was a decision to exclude survivors of domestic and sexual violence and keep that pot limited to sort of general crime victims. So this would really go to programs that provide direct services and advocacy for domestic and sexual violence victims to be able to provide direct client assistance when they come to those programs in times of great crisis and in times of great need. So that would just be one way that this pot of money would be able to be used. Again, that's a need that we've heard really, really grow incredibly dramatically. We've even heard from some of our programs, for example, Someplace Safe took funding that was dedicated to a staff position and transferred it to direct client assistance just because the need was so great. So they did not have the ability to hire staff because they needed to meet the needs of domestic and sexual violence survivors in their community. So again, that really speaks to that need for direct client assistance. I hope that answers at least one of your questions.
Yeah, Representative Kramer, just very quickly, because I do got to keep moving here. You know, the issue around the eligibility requirements, the bill calls for that, you know, those will be developed by these groups. And Representative Mueller's question had to do with transparency around that. How do you envision that happening? And perhaps, you know, and I'll leave this perhaps just hanging because we're not moving the bill today. Perhaps we may want to have more prescriptive language around, you know, that transparency, if you will, relative to the development of those eligibility requirements. But just your quick thoughts about that.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Appreciate that. I would say absolutely this will be done in partnership with, again, our state funding administrator. So we would be doing with the Office of Justice Programs, who is already administering funds that include funding for direct client assistance. So we would certainly work with them and are open to continuing a conversation around this.
Yeah, Representative Hollins, there might be some comfort language here, I think, perhaps, you know, aligned with that intent, but you know, you'll keep working on this, though, Donna. Representative Mueller, I see you nodding, so maybe you could also lend a hand then as well. All right, I have one hand left, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative Hollins, I just have a couple questions for you and a brief concern that Representative Raleigh also brought up. The first is, I'm just wondering if this funds is on top of the funds that were passed last year during the budget cycle, because we did do some funding on this last year. Is this 12 plus million on top of that funding for 2023?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. That's my understanding, yes.
Ms. Kramer, yes.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it is on top of that. And I will note that the $5 million that was appropriated last year is one-time funds.
Thank you. I thought so, and I was kind of digging around for my memory on that, Ms. Kramer. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. I missed Dan because of that. I assume that these funds are on top of the funds that we already send out to our counties and our judicial system for the crime victim services that and the services coordinator and all the stuff that they do in our county attorney's offices. And unlike what Representative Frazier said, by the numbers we heard today, it's more than just an uptick in crime. It's an avalanche. Crime is out of control, and we have to do something to get it done. We have to do what we can to help the victims. But I also have concerns about the accountability of the funding. I'm sure many of you have heard on the federal investigation into not just one, but sounds like a couple different organizations, that it sounds like it could be up to $400 million plus dollars in fraudulent expenses and fraud in the federal program. I want to make sure we don't do that in our state programs with the limited funds that we do have. So I would hope that we'd work at getting audits on these things and requiring audits where the funding is going. And not just independent audits, but maybe we should set it up so the OLA can actually do the audits as well, because right now they cannot. Right now, OJP receives roughly a little over $90 million a year for grants. I think it's something we need to look at. It's a lot of money we're giving out to grants. Some of them are good, some of them I'm not so sure. But what bothers me the most out of that $90 million that we go out to help victims of crime, OJP takes over $2 million of that besides their budget to administer these grants. We need to start looking at the amount of money that we're using on grants and that we're paying OJP and other organizations to administer these, because it's one thing if it's a $50,000 grant at 2.5%, but when we're talking 12, and this one going through the whole thing is over $17 million added to the base and $100 million over the next few years, that's a lot of money going to OJP to do these. A lot more than they've been doing this for so long, they should have the programs and their computers already set to be able to go through it. So I think we need to start looking at where the money is going, who's getting the money, and make sure the money is going where it needs to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. There's a lot there, and I think we're going to have some really good, deep conversations when we hear from the department's budget. Representative Hollins, I do note that your bill is a bill to award grants to victims, survivors, and not necessarily to our bureaucracy, even though our bureaucracy may be needed for sure. Representative Hollins, we're going to move, and so I'm going to ask you for your final thoughts on that, and then we're going to lay your bill over.
Absolutely, I'll be very brief. I really thank all of the representatives for bringing their questions and their inquiries and their critical thinking skills to this. I want to thank the testifiers for being here to answer so many of those technical questions. And I just want to say that I myself am really proud to stand with victim survivors when they need our help. And I think that this is a very valid need in our communities, and I hope that we can get support for it going forward. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this to bill, Representative Hollins. I also want to thank your testifiers, Directors Roller and Lopez and Ms. Kramer as well. With that, members, we will return to this later on in the session, but for now, the chair will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus bill. Members, next we have House File 2959, Representative Pinto. You have a motion for us, no doubt.
I do, Mr. Chair. I move that the House File you just referenced, which I need to get by myself in the number, but that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I anticipate the chair will be laying it over for possible inclusion in a budget bill.
Very well. Representative Pinto moves that House File 2959 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Pinto, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill is a number of years in the coming together. I'll give just a bit of context, and I have a couple testifiers as well. As members will recall and be aware, I served as a prosecutor in Ramsey County and have specialized in domestic violence cases and then also in sexual exploitation, sex trafficking cases, and spent several years as the director of the Safe Harbor training and protocol development area for our state. I started that work before being elected to the legislature, and then my first year in the legislature initiated some grants to the first ever statewide grants to investigate sex trafficking. Those were started in 2015, and I need to give a shout out to the then chair of this committee, Tony Cornish, who moved them through the House. It was my first year as a minority member, and he brought that in, and that ended up passing for, I think, $200,000 at that point. Those grants have since grown to be about $1 million a year. Members, you should have materials, I believe, that show kind of where those grants have gone over the past number of years and applications as well. Those grants were, to a certain extent, modeled on some grants that we have to investigate drug and gun trafficking. Through the violent crime enforcement teams, they're called, or VSETs. And it's been bothering me for a long time that we spend so much less to investigate the trafficking of human beings than we do to investigate the trafficking of drugs and guns in our state. And that's no criticism of the latter effort, but recognizing that there is such a need for the former as well. So the bill before you would increase the grants to investigate the trafficking of people to match the grants that we have to investigate the trafficking of drugs and guns. And it's as simple as that. I have a couple of folks who are involved in Central Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force. I think I'm saying that right, and they'll be able to describe that. And recipients of grants through this as well, and then also testify for the Women's Foundation in Minnesota, which has been a real leader in this all the way along. So I think we're starting with County Attorney Janelle Kendall, Mr. Chair, and I think Chief Dave Benfrood is will be available for questions as well from Central Minnesota, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Pinto, and County Attorney Janelle Kendall, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Kendall. I'm Stearns County Attorney, one of the founding members of the Central Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force, and Chief Dave Benfrood is here with me today. He is also the guy who literally got this rolling in St. Cloud. Since 2018, in our first grant funding, we literally got our first dollar of this the day that Backpage was shut down. So from the very beginning, we've had to go out and find traffickers and find victims of our own volition and do the hard work that requires at the ground level. Since that time, we've had over 350 tips. We've conducted over 100 criminal investigations. We've charged at least 50 traffickers and have had a trial where we actually had not only trafficking victims, but buyers of sex testify against a sex trafficker, in which we were able to get a statutory maximum 300 months in prison. Our task force includes not only law enforcement agencies, and we do have now 3 full-time funded investigators in the Waite Park Police Department, the St. Cloud Police Department, and the Stearns County Sheriff's Office. We also have victim assistance persons in our office who are not grant funded who work with us. Terrebinth Refuge is an adult victim shelter in Waite Park. We have a data analyst also funded by Stearns County that's part of this team. We work with the Central Minnesota Sexual Assault Center, the city attorney's office who handles the regulation of massage parlors, and critical partner, Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, who through separate funding is part of this task force. We also work with the BCA's statewide task force. They have 2 investigators here in St. Cloud. We use their services in their labs and breaking into the traffickers' phones when we need to get evidence based on search warrants for those phones. But we also work with the International Crimes Against Children Task Force, identifying child victims that we find. What are we doing with your money? We are catching traffickers, we are recovering victims, and we are prosecuting buyers. We have trained hotel and motel staff. We have trained city bus drivers, churches, civics groups, medical staff, our child advocacy center. And to give you specific examples, just this very morning, we arrested an offender who had been offering his apartment for trafficking activities and taking some of the benefits of that. We had 28 adult buyers charged in the last 3 months alone, another four traffickers in the last 3 months, and another 10 persons who solicit juveniles in the last 3 months. One of the bigger cases in 2021 was a foster parent who had asked to see her 13-year-old foster child's phone, and we ended up charging at least four, perhaps five, different guys for paying her for sex acts just by asking to look at her phone and see what's been going on. We put out ads for adult buyers, and we literally reel them in. We put out ads for persons who are posing as persons being 15 years old or less, plenty of demand there. And again, 13-year-old victims were actually the focus of the majority of the trafficking cases that we had in the last year. So this is everywhere. It's not just in St. Cloud, but with the grant funds provided by this legislature and the expertise from Representative Pinto, as well as the Washington County Task Force and the BCA Task Force, we have made significant inroads into finding our victims. One of the last ones we found this year, literally a trafficker was out on warrant, found a victim, followed her down to Rochester, and literally caught him in the act of selling her in an apartment building in Rochester. So what we've done here is not just about central Minnesota. This is where we're finding the victims. This is where we're finding the traffickers. But this is a national, international, and statewide event. And we not only very much appreciate the funding that has been provided to us, but also to the other task forces across the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, County Attorney Kendall. Thank you for your work as well. We heard from you in the past as well, and from the Central Minnesota Task Force, which has really kind of been leading the way, I think, in our state in terms of how to be effective in this massive effort to interrupt and to bring to justice those who are preying on our citizens, particularly our young citizens. With that, we do have two other testifiers, Ms. Gloria Perez with the Women's Foundation, a good friend of mine, always good to see you. Welcome, Ms. Perez.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Mariani. Wonderful to see you, Lee Johnson, and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Perez, and I'm the President and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Pinto's bill to appropriate funding for the essential work of coordination and assistance in prosecuting sex trafficking cases. Representative Pinto, thank you for all you have done to bring this horrific crime out of the shadows and to support the research, legislation, and training for our nationally recognized safe harbor model and to prosecute this crime that continues to victimize our most vulnerable young people and adults as long as demand exists. Sex trafficking has no place in Minnesota, but it's a reality that too many Minnesotans face. By funding comprehensive avenues for smart prosecution, we can prevent this abuse. As a statewide community foundation since 1983, the Women's Foundation is more than just a funder. We are committed to working with and for communities to address the greatest challenges facing women and girls across the state through grant making, research, and public policy. Like you, we want to see Minnesota be a state we can all be proud of, where everyone can live in safety. Audre Lorde said, "We believe that there is no single issue struggle, and there is no single sector solution. We will only end this crime by working together across sectors to collectively address this issue from trauma-centered care and response for survivors to prevention, to funding law enforcement's ability to break the market for sex buying." For context, in 2010, when we began to address the reality of sex trafficking with our Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale campaign, 0% of state funding was devoted to this issue. As a part of our collective effort, we were proud to work with partners across the state, including Representative Pinto, to create a response so that no child could be purchased for sex and victims would not be prosecuted as criminals. Investments across the state to resource this work and change policies, laws, and care have been instrumental in disrupting the sex trafficking market and changing the narrative about trafficking. We've made lots of grants as a foundation, including the funding of law enforcement response. Until we launched the Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale, we had never funded law enforcement, but we knew that frontline responders and law enforcement were major partners in this work, and addressing their training, coordination, and equipment needs was part of prosecuting perpetrators and supporting victims and survivors. To create a Minnesota that is safe for everyone, comprehensive state funding must address every element of this crime, which, as our law enforcement community well knows, is kept hidden and ever-evolving to evade prosecution. As a result of the tireless leadership of advocates, survivors, and the critical voices of leaders like Representative Pinto and Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, we were the first state in the nation to create and fund a statewide comprehensive plan that went from $0 and no safety net to a state-funded infrastructure of $15 million per biennium. Working together, frontline leaders developed model protocols for law enforcement, increased sex trafficking charges and convictions, and trained thousands in how to spot the signs of sex trafficking. While we now have a supportive infrastructure, this work is far from over. Advocates alone cannot end the demand. We know that there is not enough safe harbor service to meet the needs of youth, and gaps persist in service to communities disproportionately impacted by sex trafficking and exploitation. While we address our funding in response to survivors, we must work in cooperation with our partners in law enforcement and prosecution to investigate, uncover, and prosecute those perpetrators while staying ahead of a target that is continuously moving to evade detection. With the research we publish every other year in collaboration with the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School, we know that violence against women is not going down, it's actually going up. When we disaggregate the data by race and ethnicity, we see that Minnesotans who are already experiencing the greatest inequities in our state are most vulnerable to the crime of trafficking. In 2019, an evaluation of Safe Harbor found that the vast majority of participants, 91%, were female, 6% were male, and 3% were transgender or gender expansive. Statewide, more than half of the participants, 59%, served by Safe Harbor were people of color. We see high proportions of Native American participants in the program compared to the population in the state, 14% in Greater Minnesota and 9% in the Twin Cities. It's important to note that there are far more who survive trafficking than we can count. From our partners in research, we know how challenging it is to estimate the prevalence of this crime, and that our estimates almost certainly represent an undercount, as far more people experience trafficking than access services. We know that causes of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation are much bigger than any one system can address alone. We must change the culture and the demand that permits trafficking to exist, and with it, change the systems that perpetuate inequities and destabilize families, while we dismantle illegal economies with lifelong human consequences. And so to be successful and end sex trafficking, we activate several levers. While we invest in investigation, coordination, and prosecution, we must invest in prevention to educate and engage boys and men as leaders in the movement and commit to a future of safety, opportunity, and respect for all women and girls. Working together, we must invest in a state where human life is valued and quality of life is assured, to be a beacon to other states in our response and support for survivors. We must prosecute the perpetrators and invest in technology, coordination, and expertise to bring down what we know is a complex and hidden crime. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. Thank you. Thanks to the Women's Fund Foundation, rather, for the leadership work and the investment work that's helped this state develop and still developing powerful interruptions and efforts to end sex trafficking in our state. And thank you personally for quoting wilderness feminist civil rights leader Audre Lorde. You made my day with that. So very well. Our final testifier is Director Tricia Hummel of the Office of Justice Programs. We've got, I really want to make sure we...
I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe that Ms. Hummel is just here for questions, as is Chief, and Chief Benchrude of the Wade Park Police Department is here as well. But yeah, in the interest of time, I think they're both just available for questions, but done with the testimony. And I do want to echo your thanks to Ms. Perez and the Women's Foundation, because they were the ones that got me into this, and it's been, it's been pretty amazing. Anyway. But that's all. I think we're ready for questions, Mr. Chair.
Very well. And welcome to Chief and also to Ms. Hummel. We do have a question from Representative O'Neill.
Just very quickly. So to Ms. Kendall, we changed the laws here in Minnesota. They went into effect on September 15th. We rewrote a good large section of criminal sexual conduct. But one of the most pertinent things, I think, to your testimony is that we increased the age that's considered a child from under 13 to under 14. And you did reference the 13-year-old that you got into her phone and were able to press charges based on some of that evidence. And I'm wondering, are you seeing a difference now since we've increased the age of what's considered a child? Has that been helpful?
It is helpful. The sentencing changes that we did, the public, private, all of the laws that went into effect September 1st, we have put into great use already in the last quarter of the year. Yes.
Well, that was our hope. So I'm glad to hear already, just a few months after that, that we're seeing results. So I shout out to Representative Mueller and look forward to working on some other things with her as well. Thanks, everybody, for your support and making those changes. And you can see that they're taking effect.
And a shout out to you as well, Representative O'Neill. It's been one of my privileges to work with people like you and Representative Mueller in helping to shape not only the legal statutory framework in our state, and of course, Representative Pinto, but also impacting the culture and the way we begin to think and envision what a truly humanistic society free of sexual predation, should look like. So we have Representative Rowley and then Representative Johnson.
Chair, Representative Johnson was first, I was second, unless you want to call on me first.
I kind of like, waiting for me to go last.
Thanks.
But I'll leave it for you two to figure it out.
Oh, Representative Raleigh can go first.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Mr. Chair, to the author, the bill doesn't specify whether the $3,026,000 is a one-time or if it's added to the base. And I just wonder what the intent is on that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh. So the plan is to treat the trafficking of people the same as drugs and guns. And so to answer your questions, it's in the base in both cases. So the bill would add it to the base.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's make sure that happens, Representative Pinto. You're good, Representative Raleigh? Very well. Representative Jackson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pinto. I want to thank you for the work on this. And I also want to thank County Attorney Kendall for the work she's done there. I know a few officers in that area that have been working with that. And it shows what collaboration between all units of the criminal justice system can do to combat a very serious issue. I know St. Cloud at one time was really inundated with this problem. And I think the work they've done has curbed it quite a bit, but they still have a long ways to go. We need to do all we can to protect these, especially the kids that are involved and put into the sex trafficking. So I just wanted to thank County Attorney Kendall for the work she's done.
Very well. Thank you. Appropriate, Representative Johnson. Representative Pinto, last thoughts, take us out here.
Yeah, just very, Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I echo the thanks to the testifiers. I want to just highlight two things. One is I want to make sure to give particular thanks to the Office of Justice Programs, which has been administering these grants. I have found them. We have, I think it's Assistant Director Helmo is her title, but Director Kate Weeks and folks on the staff, Claire Cambridge, I have found to be just extremely sharp and driven in this area. And thanks to them. And then my second point I want to make is just echo the points made by Ms. Perez. We are all, of course, focusing on human trafficking from a prosecution and investigation side of things. But as Ms. Perez said, if we really want to address the exploitation of people in our state, we'll make sure that people are housed, that they have the food that they need, that they will have the shelter and the education. And so social investments in those things are, that is anti-trafficking work when we do that. It's not often the work directly of this committee, but if you want to fight crime, investing in human beings makes a big difference. And it's very obvious when it comes to exploitation and trafficking because it's vulnerable people who are the ones who get exploited and involved in this. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. And thanks to members.
Thank you, Representative Bentley. I also want to thank the testifiers as well. With that, Representative Pinto, we're going to, the chair will lay over, make sure I have the right number here. We're going to lay over House File 2959. We did not amend it. House File 2959 for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus bill. With that, members, we're going to move to Representative Bonner's bill, House File 2734. And I'm wondering if our vice chair, Representative Frazier, would be so kind as to make a motion to refer House File 2734 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair, I will make that motion.
Very well. The motion is before us. Representative Bonner, welcome to the committee. Your bill is before us. There is an amendment, an A1 amendment, and I guess my question is whether you want to take up the amendment right away or you want to pick it up later.
If it's all right, I'd prefer to wait till the end, Chair.
Okay, very well. Let's do that then. Representative Bonner, welcome again to our committee. Please tell us about House File 2734.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm excited to be here with you today to talk about House File 2734. As we know, you know, one in three women and approximately one in nine men will be a victim of domestic abuse. That's about 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner. That breaks down to 10 million individuals annually, and that's nearly double the population of every Minnesotan in the state. These facts are, in fact, stark, but what's more jarring is that no one is immune. In my safe community, I've met a woman who feared for the safety of her daughter and her grandchildren after escaping her husband. I met the founders of Love Conquers Violence, formed by the tragic death of Natalie Bracel, a college graduate of St. Olaf, eighth in her class in med school. And I met Lisa and Bill Pugh, who you talked to today, who started Maria's Voice after the loss of their daughter Maria to a man who had a pattern of partner violence that went unchecked. Too much sadness and too much pain. So when I was approached about yet another community member in harm's way, I was compelled to act. I want to thank Officer Dam with the Domestic Violence Unit and Chief Warner in Maple Grove for their trust and their efforts to keep our community safer. This bill is the result of that effort, months of research, consultation, and advice, which have led to the bill. And with that, it is a simple bill. Back in 2008, the legislature updated the list of pre-qualifying offenses around domestic violence, adding first and second degree murder, while a separate bipartisan bill adding first and second degree manslaughter, however, failed to be included in the final bill. Today, I'm seeking to rectify that omission by adding these offenses, which have a direct bearing on a case in my community. And adding two other serious domestic violence-related offenses, kidnapping and false imprisonment. While these additions cannot bring back any of the smart and vivacious young women we have lost in my community, it is my hope that with the partnership of Senator Julia Coleman and Senator Carla Bingham,
in the Senate, that we can take one small step to right a wrong, close a loophole, and prevent yet another senseless tragedy. And with that, I do have a few testifiers here today, particularly for the Maple Grove Police Department, Judge Mapley representing Hennepin County attorneys, as well as Bill and Lissa Pugh from Maria's Voice.
Very well. Members and testifiers, we have 20 minutes before we need to adjourn, so please keep that in mind as we offer our wisdom and as we offer inquiries. Representative Bonner, I've got the officer Dom listed first. So it looks like that's the way to go. So officer, please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kate Dam. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this important issue. I have been a Maple Grove police officer for 6 years. I've done graduate work in criminal justice and have advanced training in crisis intervention and trauma-informed interviewing. I am currently assigned to patrol and lead our department's domestic violence response team, or DIVERT for short, as we call it. Our team works with victims to connect them to community resources, provide support, and partner with them to prevent future violence. I've been working with victims as a member of DIVERT since 2018 and was recently appointed team lead in August of 21. During that time, I've crossed paths with victims whose stories demonstrate the problems with the statutory loophole this bill addresses. One in particular was especially powerful for me. This victim was assaulted by her abuser in a recurring pattern of violence, and we were called several times to literally rescue her and her children. This victim lived in a constant state of fear, unable to feel safe in her own home and sleep at night because of her abuser. Her abuser had shot his previous girlfriend to death and left her to die in an alley. He had entered a plea for second-degree manslaughter and was convicted. Because second-degree manslaughter was not included in that list of previous qualified domestic violence-related offenses, we were unable to aggravate the repeated charges against him and truly hold him accountable. The difference between a misdemeanor and felony domestic assault charge affects detention time, bail, interim pretrial conditions, and the consequences for the abuser. Domestic violence can happen multiple times in the same relationship and multiple times across multiple relationships, as Representative Bonner stated. Our goal is to prevent domestic violence, protect victims, and hold abusers accountable. Thank you again for the opportunity to be invited to speak for this bill and to be a part of advocating for changes that will better protect our communities.
Thank you, Officer Dam, for your testimony and for your ongoing work as a public servant as well. Thank you. Next, we have, I believe, Chief Eric Werner from the Maple Grove Police Department. Chief, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani. It's good to be back here, and I want to thank you and the committee for my opportunity to speak today as well. My name is Eric Werner. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maple Grove, and I've been a police officer for nearly 34 years. Throughout my career, I worked towards ending domestic violence as a frontline officer, supervising a specialty unit responsible for the prevention and investigation of domestic violence incident, and to now leading a highly professional agency that values safe and healthy relationships among its community and makes community response to the prevention of domestic violence a priority. I value and respect Officer Dom's professional opinions and expertise in the area of domestic violence, as she testified here today in her work through the Domestic Violence Response Team. I'm providing my comments today in support of House File 2734 that is under consideration by the committee, which adds first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, kidnapping, and false imprisonment crimes to the statutory definition of a qualified domestic violence-related offense. Experience and research have shown that domestic violence occurs within current relationships and will transfer from one relationship to another. Therefore, including these crimes will assist police and prosecutors in understanding the most accurate information of an abuser's history and to hold them accountable for their actions to the fullest extent. I also want the committee to consider information from the 2020 homicide report, Relationship Abuse in Minnesota, that tracks the known number of Minnesotans killed due to domestic violence, which varies from year to year. Violence Free Minnesota has compiled this report annually for the past 30 years. This organization, formerly known as Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, is a statewide coalition of over 90 member programs working to end relationship abuse. Within the report, it states a perpetrator's history of violence is a lethality factor, and that is something that our team assesses on every domestic violence call. We strive to capture information as much information as possible regarding a perpetrator's history of violence. And since our main source of information regarding a perpetrator's history of violence is through public court records, the report is limited in their analysis. According to the Violence Free Minnesota, at least 9 perpetrators in 2020 had documented histories of violence against their current and or former partners, children, and parents, family members, and at least 5 had known but undocumented histories. Perpetrators' histories of violence often do not begin or end with one victim. In some cases, there may be a history of violence against previous and subsequent partners as well, up to and including homicide. Finally, I want to thank the work of all the legislatures in this matter. Officer Dom worked alongside Representative Bonner, as well as Representative Robbins, who also authorized a bill, which is House File 3049. In that bill, it includes the crime of third-degree murder in addition to the added crimes in House File 2734. Myself and Officer Dom think it is important to include third-degree murder because spouses or significant others can provide drugs to their partner, causing their death. Drugs are often a tool in abusive or trafficking relationships to control the other person. Causing a death through drugs in previous relationships should be an element that enhances domestic violence. Again, I want to thank Representative Bonner and Officer Dom their proposal with this legislation and their testimony today, and we are ready to finalize any legislation that comes out of this session that will give us the ability to aggravate charges in domestic violence cases. For these previous offenses is an important tool for law enforcement to stem domestic violence. So, Mr. Chair, again, thank you for the opportunity today, and I'll stand for questions if needed.
Thank you, Chief, for your testimony and also for your work. Representative Bonner, we have 13 minutes left before we are compelled to adjourn. We do have an amendment that maybe someone will offer. We need to act on. We do have 2 or 3 testifiers here. I guess I'm going to leave it to you on how we should proceed with the possibility we may not be able to do anything with this bill if we run out of time. So, your guidance, Representative Bonner. And you're muted. I'm sorry.
Apologies. If we need to move the amendment, we can certainly do that and then see if we have sufficient time to hear from Judge Mabley. I know he is here, and we do have the folks from Maria's Voice as well.
Very well. Is anyone interested in moving the A1 amendment? I guess that's the first thing. Representative Olivia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is my amendment. And I believe that the previous testifier, Chief Werner, just set it up for me. So he explained very articulately why we actually do really need third-degree murder added back into the bill. And not only is it in a situation where it's a domestic situation, but also sex traffickers. So sex traffickers also use drugs often to control their victims. And in so doing, sometimes they die. In fact, many times they die. The life expectancy of someone who is actively sex trafficked is 5 years, according to Polaris. It is egregious. And so we absolutely must include the third degree murder, which is what this amendment does, back into the bill. That is included in Representative Kristen Robbins' bill. And I think it's really vital that we put it back in. And that is why I drafted the amendment to be added back in. And as you heard from the chief and from the officer, from Officer Dom, that it's really important. And they did talk about the domestic side, but I think you also have to think about sex traffickers as well and how abusive that they are. So that is the reason for the amendment. I really hope you can support it. I like the bill as a whole. this would make it, this would put the icing on top if we can add that back in, and I can be fully supportive. And I know Representative Bonner asked if I would sign on the bill, and once this goes on, I absolutely will sign on the bill and push it all the way through.
Representative O'Neill moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion. Representative Pinto.
Just a gentle pushback to my friend and colleague, Representative O'Neill, about that. I don't know that I necessarily see what you're mentioning about. It's certainly true that traffickers give use drugs to control victims. I think it's at least as common that people are being exploited or taking drugs just to deal with the situation. I don't know that I necessarily see the connection with Murder 3, but having said that, I think that it would be a harmless addition. I don't know that it's going to come up very often at all these situations, but I certainly would defer to the bill's author in terms of beyond that. Just want to make that comment on trafficking.
Thanks. And Representative Bonner is the bill's author.
Yes. Thank you for that, Chair Mariani. And I will tell you, in doing my homework on this particular bill, the reason I had not originally included Murder 3 is that there didn't seem to be as direct of a link in terms of intent. However, I will be upfront in saying that I have no opposition to adding this amendment to the bill. And so I would encourage members to go ahead and vote their conscience on this. But I am certainly agreeable to adding that onto the bill if that is the will of the body.
Well, I think we're probably ready to vote, Representative Johnson. I'm thinking a voice vote here.
Voice vote will be fine.
Very well. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And House File 2734 is amended with the A1 amendment. We have 9 minutes. I'm going to call on Mr. Mabley and ask for his condensed version. I apologize to you, sir, but I sure do want to make sure we get in Lisa and Bill Pugh before we adjourn. Please, sir, state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
And good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dan Mabley, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee. I am the Chief Criminal Deputy in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And just a brief background, for 18 years, I was a criminal prosecutor and supervisor in the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, the Dakota County Attorney's Office, and now the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I was appointed to the Hennepin County District Bench in 1992 and served there for 27 years until I reached the mandatory retirement age for judges. And then in July of this year, Mike Freeman asked me to return to full-time work as the Chief Criminal Deputy. As you know, House File 2734 would amend Minnesota Statute 609.02 Subdivision 16, which defines the term qualified domestic violence-related offenses and does so by listing several serious person crimes like murder, assault, criminal sexual conduct, malicious punishment of a child, and terroristic threats. This definition is important because if a person is convicted of a qualified domestic violence-related offense and then later commits certain lower level person crimes, such as fifth degree assault, domestic assault, violation of a harassment restraining order, harassment, stalking, any of those, that prior conviction can be used to enhance the criminal penalty. And basically, that was the purpose of the original statute, was to increase penalties for individuals who continue to commit person crimes. So when it was originally adopted, the crimes listed here were somehow left out. I think they are consistent with the crimes that were originally included, think this would close a gap in the law where some serious crimes are recognized for enhancement, but others aren't. And as to the third degree murder, I actually have discussed this with Representative Boehner, and I have no objection to that either. I think it would be a fine inclusion in the bill. Along with the kidnapping, false imprisonment, and first and second degree manslaughter. I just feel like this bill would ultimately help and protect victims of domestic violence. So I want you to know that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office supports House File 2734, and as well as the it enjoys the support from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And thanks, Representative Boehner, for your leadership on this issue.
And thank you, sir, for your testimony here, and also for your service as a public servant in our state. Lisa and Bill Pugh, I want to apologize ahead of time because we're basically down to 5 minutes, and I have no doubt that we can spend a lot more time than that, and perhaps in the future that might allow. But if you can please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us a very concise sharing inside of 5 minutes, and then we'll take the formal actions to keep this bill alive and moving. So I don't know who's going to go first, but
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
This is Bill Pugh speaking. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Mariani and committee members. I'm Bill Pugh of Chaska, Minnesota, here with my wife, Lisa Weimel. We are the co-founders of Maria's Voice, a nonprofit creating awareness about necessity for domestic violence prevention education. We're here to testify in support of HF 2734. Maria's Voice honors the life of our daughter, Maria Pugh, who was murdered in her home in Maple Grove, Minnesota, by her domestic abuser husband in April of 2020. We are grateful to the Maple Grove Police Department, who carefully obtained evidence for a second-degree murder charge against Maria's killer. We are equally grateful to the Hennepin County prosecutors, who used the powers of the existing laws to prosecute this domestic abuser, obtaining a sentence of 38 and a half years in prison for murdering Maria Pugh. It is no consolation, as we would give anything to have Maria here today, enjoying her happy 30-year-old life, maybe having our grandkids or playing with her beautiful black lab, Rocky. Maria was taken away from our family, friends, cousin, loving parents, and community. But most important of all, Maria lost everything when a domestic abuser willfully ended her life. Now I'll introduce my wife, Lisa.
Thank you, sir. Lisa, welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you so much, and I'll make it very quick as well. Thank you. Bill and I really ask that I'm Lisa Weimel, I'm Maria Pugh's mom, and Bill and I ask the committee respectfully for the inclusion of the first and second degree manslaughter charge and at the charge of kidnapping, because it addresses the reality of domestic abusers and their behavior. Abusers who wreak havoc on the resources of police, they fill our courts, they fill our medical and our social systems. They deserve to be punished for their social behavior, just as the law metes out consequences for any other killer or any other kidnapper. It's really imperative to hold abusers accountable for this cunning crime that betrays their intimate partner and leaves so many lives scarred forever. Until prevention education, and that's what we love to talk about is prevention, until prevention education receives the funding and the attention equal to the aftermath of violence, we urgently ask you to come together in bipartisan unity to pass House File 2734. And on behalf of those victimized and those whose lives were taken, Maria Pugh thanks you, and so do Bill and I. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weimel and Mr. Pugh. And thank you for the incredible words of love that you shared here. Love is a powerful thing. It's not a passive thing. And I think you honor your beloved daughter's life by continuing to live your life with that power and requesting and requiring that our state government both do this as well as work to prevent it from happening again in the future. Our blessings to you. Representative Bonner, that concludes then with barely a minute left here today. So just a few words from you, and then we're going to, and by the way, members and to the public, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion, which means this bill is still very much alive. And the reason for that is that we'll need a fiscal note on this to look at what the potential costs, most likely to our our correction system, and then we'll have to make the adjustments as we put together our budget part of our bill to reflect that. But this is not the last day, certainly, of this discussion. Representative Bowder.
I just want to say very briefly, thank you so much to my testifiers for being here today. Your trust and your ability to help really bring our community together are so fundamentally important. So I'm really grateful for that. And of course, I am grateful that we were able to come to an agreement and of course win over the support of my friends on the other side of the aisle as well. It has always been my intent from day one to have this be a bipartisan effort. So I'm grateful for that as well. And with that, I will let us go to a vote.
Very well. Thank you for your work, Representative Bonner. Well done. Members, the chair will now lay this bill over. House File 2734 as amended for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus bill later on in this session. I want to thank all the testifiers here today. We're going to adjourn in about five seconds. I want folks to know that we will convene again this Thursday. We have two bills up, or Representative Bowler's bill in regards to stolen vehicles investigation and Representative Pinto bill. And I think we may still yet add another bill for that day. So please stay tuned. So until Thursday, this committee stands adjourned.